The House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 8:03 Friday, April 23rd. Members present include Representatives Shragi, Fields, Sponholz, Nelson, and Snyder. Thanks to our secretary today, Leah, and moderator, Tom. As a reminder, please announce yourself for House records when you speak. Today we have a first hearing on House Bill 159, the Administration's Consumer Data Privacy Act. We have a first hearing on House Bill 146, Representative Snyder's Disclosure of Wage Information. A second hearing on Representative Nelson's House Bill 125, and a second hearing on the Administration's House Bill 75 related to PERS and TERS. Any questions before getting started? Seeing none. First up, we have House Bill 159, Consumer Data Privacy, being presented today by Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills and Assistant Attorney General John Haley. This is the first hearing of the bill in Labor and Commerce. Thanks for introducing and explaining the bill, Ms. Mills and Mr. Haley.
Thank you to the committee. For the record, this is Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division at the Department of Law. And I have to apologize, I have a little bit of feedback. I hope you're not hearing that as well.
We're not yet.
Oh, good. So Co-Chairs Fields and Sponholz and members of the committee, I'm really happy to be here today to introduce House Bill 159, the Consumer Data Privacy Act. As a starting point, this is really a bill that's looking at trying to protect Alaskans' right to privacy. As we all know, Alaskans put a great value in their privacy, and this is evidenced by our very unique constitutional provision that has a right to privacy within our Constitution, an explicit right. Alaskans are concerned that large social media companies, you know, think Facebook and Google and other businesses, think Amazon, are collecting and using their personal information in ways that negatively impact their privacy. So on the other hand, we also have to think about our business interests, right? And we want a thriving economy. One of this administration's core initiatives is to make Alaska open for business. And there's really a tension between, you know, making sure we protect Alaskans' legitimate concerns about their privacy and their control over their own personal information, and also not overly burdening, especially our small and mid-sized businesses that we really need to keep the economy, you know, running. So HB 159 is kind of a starting place. It begins a necessary conversation about how to properly balance those two goals, protecting Alaskans' privacy and creating an environment where Alaskan companies can thrive. So when we look at HB 159, the core purpose, as I kind of said before, is to provide Alaskans with the ability to know what information is being collected by companies, their information, and to gain more control over how that personal information is being used and passed on. And I have to apologize for the dog in the background. At this point, I just want to be upfront that the administration's view of the bill, after having been introduced and hearing concerns, is that this bill does need substantial additional work to find that right balance. We wanted to put this out there. We wanted to start the conversation. But specifically, we want to hear from the business community. They're the ones who will know how this impacts, how is this workable, how can this be implemented appropriately. I think everybody holds the goal that we want to protect the privacy of personal information, that we want people to have more control. But I think there's a balance there that needs to be struck. So, as I think you've already heard, I think the committee has at least one letter. We've already started hearing from business interests. We have begun those stakeholder discussions. And we also encourage this committee to do the same and to hear from the different groups so we can find the right path. Having this bill in front of the legislature now, I think, allows those conversations and discussions to occur now and over the interim, and to bring the various stakeholders to the table to truly understand both the positive and the negative ramifications. We believe this will make the bill better, and that through the help of the committee and hearing from stakeholders, we can narrow the scope and find that right balance. So that's the overall big picture about this bill. And now I'm going to hand it over to Assistant Attorney General John Haley, one of our consumer protection experts at the department. He'll take us through the sectional, unless there are questions at this point for me on the big picture.
Ms. Mills, I might just note that Representatives Kaufman and McCarty got here at 8:05, and sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, Mr. Haley.
All right. Thank you. For the record, John Haley, Assistant Attorney General at the Alaska Department of Law. And with your permission, I will go through the sectional analysis. So Section 1 of this bill adds a new duty for the Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and it asks the department to establish a data broker registry. The concept of the data broker registry is something that maybe will be easier to talk about as we get a little bit further into Section 2 of the bill. So if there's no questions, I'll just move on to Section 2. Section 2 establishes the Consumer Data Privacy Act as AS 45.49. This is the main section of the bill, and it lays out the bill in several articles. So my intention would be to kind of go through these statutory section by statutory section. And so in Article 1, the first section we see is AS 45.49.010. This section requires that a business notify a consumer before collecting personal information from that consumer. And I think, you know, here before I go forward, it's good to talk about the definition of business. So the word business you'll hear continuously as we go through this sectional analysis and talk about the bill. But the bill does, in the definition section, define business. And business is defined as a company acting for profit that meets one of any three thresholds, either has annual gross revenues of $25 million or more. That's the first. The second is buys or discloses the personal information of 100,000 persons or households. And the third is if the business engages in the sale of personal information. So a business would have to notify a consumer before collecting that consumer's personal information. Notifications under the section would have to include the categories of personal information being collected, the purpose for collecting that personal information, the rights that the consumer has to opt out of the sale of their personal information as well. This information and other detailed information relating to the personal information collected would have to be maintained and updated as part of the business's online privacy policy and consumer privacy rights or business website. The businesses subject to this section are also charged with training staff and answering questions about consumer rights. I guess I should ask, are there any questions about this section?
Representative Vanas.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. How many businesses would meet the definition that's in the bill so far?
Through the chair to co-chair Sponholz, I think that I don't have the answer for that at this time. And I guess I can tell you that I think part of the difficulty in getting the answer to this question is that, you know, other than companies that have to publicly file reports for security purposes or some reason like that, we don't necessarily have access to know what each business's gross annual revenues are. So when we talk about, you know, most LLCs or S-Corps or partnerships, we don't necessarily know. And so it may be possible to get some estimates, but I don't have that information today at least.
All right, thank you. I think that's going to be an important data point moving forward.
It does relate to enforcement, and I know that other states have put in place different enforcement models, and I'm definitely curious about what the department's thoughts are on that, because if we don't have enforcement, it's sort of meaningless, because these companies won't automatically be disclosing their income data that we can set in a way that we can track them anyway. And that is one thing that I noticed I think might need some changes in the bill just to make sure it has some teeth. So thanks for your consideration of that.
Okay, thank you. And I'll move on to the next one, which is 45.49.015. this section requires that a person who receives personal information that was originally collected by a business as defined in the chapter for a business or commercial purpose must notify the business of the person's possession and provide their contact information. The person must also either de-identify the personal information or maintain it in such a way that it could be deleted upon a deletion request. And deletion request comes up a little bit later in the bill, but as we'll see, consumers would have the right to make a request to the business that collected the information asking that the information be deleted.
Mr. Haley, I apologize. I might jump in here with just one more question that I should have asked on the last section. You know, looking at annual gross revenues of $25 million or more, I mean, one thing I thought about when reading the bill was a company like Beartooth, which, you know, they know my phone number when I call and order a pizza, and, you know, they're not really selling information, and how do we avoid kind of capturing mid-size Alaska businesses? So I'm sure that the administration is thinking about that as you sort of internally rewrite the bill, but I certainly don't want to capture, you know, these small to medium-sized businesses that, sure, they have your phone number because they want to be able to deliver to you and all that, but they're not actually selling your data. Representative McCarty.
Through the chair, also the question is this information businesses have to disclose that, is that public knowledge of disclosure of how much they're bringing in, or that's going to be secured for the businesses?
Through the chair, I'm sorry, if you could repeat that question.
In other words, if this is to you're monitoring how much money a business is making to see if this applies to them, is the information that a business is disclosing held in confidence with the state, or is that going to be public knowledge then? Because it seems to bring up a question of proprietary information of a business. Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Representative, thank you. Yes, that does make sense. This bill does not require companies to, you know, disclose to us, to send it to the Department of Law, some kind of statement saying, you know, what their annual gross revenues are. The bill's really simply saying that one of the ways you can become a business and be regulated under the Act is if you do have gross annual revenues of $25 million or more. So there's no requirement that businesses have to tell us how much money they make in a year, which I think goes to the point Representative Fields was making about it may be difficult for us to know exactly which businesses do and do not meet that threshold.
Thank you.
Since we're on the subject of thresholds, if I could just ask another question on that. I think Florida just passed a data privacy bill with a threshold of $50 million, and I think their criteria were an income threshold and one of these other factors versus just one of three. Could you explain what went into the thought of $25 million and what other models are out there?
To the chair, I guess all that I can say is that the $25 million number was an initial attempt by the administration to strike an appropriate balance. Florida's bill, my understanding is that, Florida does have a bill, as you're describing, that passed the House recently, the Florida State House, and may be headed to the Senate. Of the three states that have passed somewhat similar laws to this, California, Virginia, and Nevada, I think that the thing that we've done that's somewhat unique here that's not in those other states is the threshold of selling personal information, that making you a business. That's the only one that I can say is unique. And I'm not immediately able to tell you off the top of my head whether any of the other states exactly what they've done beyond that, that I don't think any of them have. Selling personal information is one of their thresholds.
Thank you.
Okay, so thank you. I'll go back to AS45.49.015. And essentially what this section does is it's creating, in a sense, a tracking requirement so that if a business collects personal information from a consumer and then passes that along to another business, they have to keep a record that business now has the personal information of the consumer. And if the business that it was passed along to passes it along to someone else, there's a requirement that that sort of second business goes back and reports to the initial collection business, hey, we've passed it along to this third person. So it's creating a sort of chain of tracking requirements that would later on help a consumer exercise some of the rights we're going to talk about in this chapter, such as the right to find out who has your personal information. That's essentially what this section is doing. Are there any questions about this section?
Not seeing any.
Okay, thank you. Then I'll move on to AS45.49.020. This is the first of the consumer rights that we're going to discuss that the bill creates. This is the right to request disclosure of collected personal information. So under this section, a consumer has the right to request that a business that collected the personal information within the last 5 years disclose the type of personal information collected, the sources from which it was collected, and the business or commercial purpose for collecting that information. And a business would be required to respond to this request under the procedures that we've laid out in a later section. I'll get to AS45.49.060. If there's no questions here, I'll move on to the next.
Go ahead.
So moving on to the next, AS45.49.030, this is the second right. This is the right to request deletion of personal information. So if a consumer's personal information is collected by a business, the consumer may request that the business delete any information collected by the business from the consumer within the last 5 years. The business would be required to delete the information identified in the request and direct the persons who have also received that information subsequently from the business to delete it. So if the business has passed that along to a second business, the second business would also be required to delete it, and the collecting business would be required to tell that second business to engage in that deletion.
I have a question on that section, Mr. Healy.
Yes.
I think Europe has some laws around the right to disappear. Let's say someone has posted, you know, slanderous information about you on the internet, and you want Google to take that information down. You know, in the U.S., Google effectively doesn't do that. In Europe, my understanding is that there's a process to remove such information. As I'm looking at this section, it seems like this only affects a business that collected the information versus a business that is posting or making available such information. So how would this section differ or be similar from, you know, the so-called right to disappear or right to remove, you know, slanderous information that you might find about yourself on the internet?
To the chair, this really is not the same as that European concept, I think, of the sort of right to be forgotten. This really is directed at the business that collected information from you, and then that business would also, as I've said, have to go to a business. You know, if they've disclosed it to a second business, they would also have to delete. But if, you know, if we're talking about somebody on a blog who doesn't qualify as a business saying slanderous things about you, this bill doesn't really deal with that concept. That's a different concept that's not dealt with in this bill.
Yeah, and I guess I was thinking more in you know, online harassment and bullying, which we see a rise in. And I guess I would be curious in terms of your analysis of whether it would be appropriate to have this be more of a right to be forgotten provision and be a little more expansive than it is now. You don't have to answer that now, but as we go forward.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm not prepared to answer that. I don't know if Ms. Mills is, but I don't have a comment to that right now. No, go ahead.
Just Corey Mills, for the record. That's something, Rep. Fields, that we can definitely consider as we look at different changes to the bill. So appreciate the comment.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I will move on to, if there's no more questions, AS45.49.040. This is sort of the third right that's noted in the bill. This is the right to request disclosure of personal information that was sold or disclosed for a business or commercial purpose. So this section gives a consumer the right to request Disclosures from business that sold or otherwise disclosed the person's personal information for business or commercial purpose within the last 5 years. So the consumer can request sort of a disclosure, a list of the people who have received that information from the business, and the business would be required to tell the consumer who they've disclosed that information to. And if there's no questions, I'll move on to 45.49.050. This creates a right to opt out and for a minor to sort of opt in, so we'll go through that. First, the section provides that a consumer can request that a business not sell that person's personal information or not sell specific categories of personal information. A business is not allowed to contact a consumer who's made this sort of opt-out request and ask them to renounce that request for at least 1 year after they've made the do not sell my data request. The section also requires that a business limit the use or disclosure of a consumer's precise geolocation data to those uses which are necessary to provide the goods or services that a customer reasonably expects from the business, the goods or services they'd reasonably expect. A business may use precise geolocation data for other purposes if the consumer gives consent in writing. So the concept of precise geolocation data is, you know, obviously that your phone or the apps on your phone or perhaps other items may know exactly where you are, and a business would be able to use that data to provide you the services you'd expect. So, you know, as an example, perhaps Google Maps could use that data to figure out how long it takes people to get from point A to point B or where the traffic jams are, but not for any other purpose unless you consent to that in writing. The section also requires the business not disclose the personal information or precise geolocation.
Mr. Haley?
Yes.
I apologize. I was just going to ask a question on that point. I think one of the criticisms of the GDPR is, you know, there's this kind of pop-up that you see at the bottom of every website. Oh, do you want to use this website? Better click this button. You click it, you know, if essentially it voids all the protections that are supposed to be contained. And, you know, I don't really know the right way to solve that, but I would just hope that in looking at this geolocation data for minors, we're not sort of replicating that structural problem that we've seen in other places. Did you have a question, Representative Snyder?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Haley. When we last spoke, we had addressed a question regarding opt-out versus opt-in approaches, and I was just curious if you had any additional thoughts on why starting with the opt-out approach. Is that typical of other models? Is there a business argument to be made for that approach?
And Representative Snyder, I think you may have actually met with a different attorney in our office, Ian Engelbeck.
So I'll pose the question fresh to you then, okay, regarding the opt-out and opt-in.
And I'm sorry, if you could rephrase that question, I'm sorry.
No problem. And if my memory serves, I believe Ms. Mills was on that call, unless I'm really losing it. But so my question is, as we're talking about the way it's worded right now, I believe, with the exception of minors, that it's presented as an opt-out option if you did not want your data shared, versus the alternate approach would be to be an opt-in option for a variety of ways in which your data could be shared. And I was curious if there are other approaches elsewhere or what the argument is for starting with that approach.
Through the chair, I guess this is an interesting question. I think whether you go with a opt-out or an opt-in is an interesting question. Obviously, the choosing to make someone opt-in is at least seemingly a stronger privacy provision than having someone have to exercise the opt-out. But as I guess Representative Fields has noted, or the Chair Fields has noted, sometimes all those opt-in and opt-outs can come flying at you. So I don't know that I have a great answer as to which one is the better approach today as a matter of policy.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I might ask a follow-up. I'm curious if there are legal models out there that differentiate between sort of advertising versus, you know, a service like Google Maps, where in the moment that you're using the geolocation data, it's definitely not being used for advertising, which is different from, you know, tracking in a store and a company says, ooh, they're about to approach the cereal. Why don't we show them an ad for cereal? I don't know if there are legal models out there to differentiate between those two functions, but they're really different in the market, and perhaps we could recognize that.
I guess to the chair, I think to some degree this concept does. I think to some degree the bill does deal with that difference. Okay. I guess it just depends. I mean, and I think that this is all very fact specific, but at least potentially, you know, depending on what app is tracking your geolocation data, if it's using it to provide some kind of advertisement that a consumer wouldn't really necessarily expect, that this app would be providing this kind of advertisement in this store, then that may be a situation where we're talking about providing, you know, using geolocation data for a purpose other than what the consumer would reasonably expect. But I guess it's a very fact-intensive process of deciding whether or not a particular use is a use that a consumer would have reasonably expected.
Thank you.
Okay, so I guess just to continue and finish up with this section, this section also requires that a business not disclose the personal information, including precise geolocation data, of a person under the age of 18. However, a parent or legal guardian may authorize the sale or disclosure of a person's personal information if the person's between the ages of 13 and 18.
Representative also has a question, okay. Mr. Healy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, Mr. Healy, I see on there it says recklessly disregards the likelihood that the consumer is under 18 years of age. And I'm not saying that I did, but, you know, back younger individuals when signing up for, say, YouTube or Facebook, and they have that already 18 and older requirement, would easily just put their age at 100 or pick some random date. So what kind of verification is in that section to say, okay, you know, this is recklessly disregarding the likelihood? You know, where does that line kind of stop at?
Through the chair, Representative, I appreciate that question, and I think in some ways it's a difficult one. You know, just speaking generally, the law has a lot of these standards, right? Negligence, reckless, that end up being very fact-intensive questions. And I think that, you know, this statute, at least in the statutory language, isn't providing, you know, specific information about exactly what would or wouldn't constitute, you know, a reckless disregard. That may be something where with regulation, some of that could be cleared up. I think part of the issue is that, you know, what would constitute a reckless disregard might depend based on the technology that's adopted in the future, and what kind of things we have. I think another way of looking at this, you know, would be similar to, I don't know, if you looked at a concept like advertising cigarettes to minors. You know, if it's a YouTube channel that's, you know, clearly directed, or some kind of app that's clearly directed at children, you know, perhaps there could be a situation where you could say that it, you know, a company's recklessly disregarding the likelihood that somebody's under the age of 13. But I guess I think it's a very fact-intensive analysis, and I can't give much of a better answer than that right now.
Representative Nelson, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand with the apps, you know, it's going back and forth, but, you know, Representative Fields had an earlier comment about small to medium size, like a bear's tooth or moose's tooth in Anchorage, where, you know, you just give them a call and they already have your phone number and they kind of know your order already. You know, someone that's 15 or 16 years old, you know, would that fall under that provision? You know, they're not necessarily going to ask the kid who's ordering pizza, hey, how old are you? You know, they're just going to take down their information and move forward. Does this fall under that provision, or?
If you give me one moment as I think through that. So through the chair, I think one important thing to keep in mind with this statutory section is that it's dealing with the sale or disclosure of the miner's data. So, you know, if you've got a pizza shop, as long as they're not selling, you know, the name and phone number to somebody else or giving it out to other companies, you know, this provision wouldn't count. There's no problem with collecting the name and phone number. It's the sale and disclosure that's really at issue.
Follow up?
And last one, I promise.
Good questions.
I understand that what I'm looking at is, you know, making sure that, you know, someone under the age of 18, if the business doesn't necessarily know or believes falsely that that person is over the age of 18 and trying to disclose it, you know, there's just that little gray area, just looking for clarification on that.
And through the chair, I think that, you know, this gets back to the concept where I think that it's, you know, going to be a case-by-case, fact-intensive analysis as to whether a particular decision, you know, would violate this statutory provision or not. And it's hard to sort of give a great clarification in a very general sense. I think that we'd have to look at very specific facts to talk about that.
Okay. Thank you, Ms.
This is Corey Mills. Again, for the record, through the chair, I just wanted to add that when you're thinking about these standards, you know, you, from a legal perspective, you usually have like negligence, and that's, you know, that's one standard. And then you have recklessly disregarding the truth. You know, that takes a little bit more. So it's a variation in scale. This definitely isn't kind of your negligence standard, which is just, did you ignore something you should have? It's higher than that, but like Mr. Haley said, it's a very fact-intensive analysis, but we, you know, it's definitely above kind of just that negligence. They, you know, negligently did something. And we can, there's various standards. There's gross negligence, recklessly disregarding the truth. There's all these legal terms that have definitely been kind of taken to court, and the court has definitely expanded on what those mean. And then you have to apply the facts. So we're happy to expound on that to help the committee understand those standards and kind of what they mean.
And I'm just going to note, you know, this is a long and complicated bill, and I think it makes a lot of sense to talk through the sectional. And if we don't get through the whole sectional today, that's fine. We're going to return to this bill. So appreciate the in-depth discussion.
All right, thank you. And I'll turn to AS45.49.060. This section lays out a process for how a business can respond to a consumer request asking for a deletion or a disclosure. A business is required first to designate at least two methods by which a consumer can submit a request. They'd have to have a toll-free number and a email address. One of the things that this section says is that information that's contained in a request can only be used to identify the personal information and comply with the request. So, for instance, a business might ask a person, you know, who's making one of these requests to prove that they are who they say they are, so that the business doesn't end up, you know, deleting information or disclosing information, you know, if some other malicious actor was going out and making that request. So they can... The business can ask somebody to prove that they are who they say they are, but they can only use that proof for the purpose of proving who they are, not for collecting this new information. If the person's requesting information, the business must provide that information in a human-readable format, electronically or by mail if requested. A business has to has to deliver the information, or if there's a deletion request, then the business has to provide confirmation that they've complied with the request to delete. A business generally has 45 days to respond under the section, but may take an additional 45 days when reasonably necessary, but the business would have to notify the consumer of that. The section prohibits a business from charging a fee for performing their obligations under this chapter. However, if a consumer's requests reach, and this is another one of those standards, the a point at which they're manifestly unfounded or excessive, a business may charge a reasonable fee or refuse to act on the request. But if either of those actions are taken, refusing to respond or charging a fee, then the business would have to notify the consumer of that decision and explain their reasons why they've concluded that the request is unreasonable or unfounded. The section also provides certain exceptions. A business that does not sell or disclose information is not required to retain information collected in a single one-time transaction. And if a business does not maintain data in a manner that would be considered personal information, then the business wouldn't have to re-identify or relink the data in response to a request. So what that means essentially is if a business kept a list of customers, but then also kept certain data about those customers, what kinds of things they ordered, where they live, that kind of thing. But the data is kept in such a way that it's essentially de-identified, that you can't link the name of the person to that personal information, then that's fine, and they wouldn't have to relink it in order to respond to, say, a disclosure request. If there's no further questions, I'll move on to the next section. The next section is AS45.49.070, which is third-party disclosure of personal information. So under this section, a third-party sounds like we have a question. No? Sorry. Thought I heard something. So under this section, a third party is prohibited from disclosing personal information if it was originally collected in violation of AS45.49.010 or AS45.49.050. And again, .010, that was the section requiring that you notify a consumer before collecting their data, and .050 deals with collecting miner's data and precise geolocation data. This does say that if the third party reasonably concludes after an inquiry that the information was not obtained in violation of these sections, then they couldn't be held liable for violating this section. A third party must have written confirmation from the original collector that the information was legally collected before disclosing that information, though, for a business or commercial purpose. So I guess in essence what this is dealing with is if a business collects information, discloses it to some third party, to some other business or person, that business can't just keep disclosing it unless they have, reasons to believe that the information was collected lawfully. So this is dealing with information, I guess the concept of information that's collected by one business and then disclosed over and over and over again through, potentially long link of chains. Are there any questions here, or shall I move on?
Representative McCarty has a question.
Hi. Through the chair, Mr. Haley, I'm trying to conceptualize the ramifications and investigation of such in the third party. So I'm going to use the simplistic mindset I'm thinking of. It's like if I have a bag of chicken feathers on a really windy day and I release those chicken feathers into the air, there is no way I'm going to collect them again. So as I think about this and go, okay, the third party is not responsible for, but they may be very much involved in the distribution of these chicken feathers all over. What are we doing to the person that's been violated to there any type of integrity that's been compromised?
Through the chair, I actually think the chicken feathers analogy is really good. I wish I had thought of that. I think that when we talk about enforcement, I think we have to be honest that enforcement is going to be a challenge. I think that, it would be difficult to know and follow where every piece of personal information that's collected goes, to see it go from one business to another. So I don't know that it's always going to be necessarily easy to figure out where personal information's gone. I mean, this is not you know, the kind of bill that's creating, you know, one highly regulated industry where, you know, the government, you know, has these incredible powers to sort of track what's happening. That's not what this bill is about. This bill is obviously much broader in scope. And so, you know, I think that we're not necessarily going to be able to know every time, you know, who's, you know, which people or persons have, you know, violated this law or, you know, sent the chicken feathers further and further out into the wind. And we'd have to rely on, you know, whistleblowers, tips, information in the tech news media. And I think that's sort of how we would figure out what's happening. I don't know if that answered the question exactly. And if it didn't, I'm happy to
follow up. Through the chair, no, I think you did a great job, and you could take my chicken feather example and propagate it all over if you want. But it does bring up, and I actually experienced this, where in my business that the Yellow Page company, when they submitted to the Yellow Pages, they misspelt my name. And a third party of Yellow Page companies just took that and ran with it. And 10 years later, in trying to get, you know, collect all these chicken feathers of what was done, that it was really the third parties involved. And I'm wondering in this situation here, if a third party in the language here says that they are not liable if the fault was to the original, yet there's a bit of involvement in the distribution of information. And are we holding them to some accountability to try to rectify that as a third party? Not necessarily holding them liable, but holding them to accountability to fix it so that helps the consumer.
Through the chair, Representative, I actually am thinking about this, and I don't think this bill deals precisely with the problem you're getting at, which is sort of you know, the ability to correct misinformation. I don't think that the bill really deals with that concept. So that's not something that I think is currently in here, but it's an interesting thing to think about.
I mean, it gets back to that right to be forgotten. I think that is an important thing, and I would be supportive of looking at whether we can address it. And then Representative McCarty, I mean, in terms of enforcement models, Mr. Haley, I don't think this bill currently has a private right of action.
To the chair, the bill does actually have private right of action.
For enforcement on provisions, generally speaking.
I'm sorry, if you could repeat that, Chair.
In sort of a broad sense, for enforcement of the provisions in the bill.
To the chair, in a broad sense, the enforcement of the bill would be through the Attorney General. What this bill provides is that a violation of the bill would be an Unfair Trade Practices Act, a violation of the Unfair Trade Practices Act. And so the Unfair Trade Practices Act is a sort of large umbrella, I would say, consumer protection statute, and we house sort of a number of other acts inside of the Unfair Trade Practices Act. So a violation of the Charitable Solicitations Act is an unfair trade practice. A violation of certain portions of the Automotor Vehicles Dealers Act are violations of the Unfair Trade Practices Act. And so this would be the same thing. A violation of this act is an unfair trade practice. And the Attorney General has a number of investigative powers in an unfair trade practices investigation, the powers to issue subpoenas for documents and for testimony. For instance, so we'd have those powers, and then the enforcement power for the Attorney General is to file an action in civil court, in Superior Court, sorry, seeking fines of up to $25,000 per violation. The Attorney General can also seek injunctions. There is a private right of action under the UTPA as well, and so this would provide for that. That's a somewhat complicated subject, which I had a little bit later on, but if you'd like to talk about that now, I could jump into what the private right of action does.
It's fine to hold it. And then the one other model, Representative McCarty, is, you know, do we try to stand up basically an enforcement section within the Department of Law that has some capabilities in this area? And, you know, if so, how do we fund it? Sorry for that interjection. Go ahead, Mr. Haley.
Thank you. And to the chair, I guess I would just note on that point, if it's helpful, that I believe the fiscal note attached to this bill does ask for one attorney and one litigation assistant to help with enforcement and also with drafting regulations. So with that, I'll move on to AS45.49.080, which is service provider obligations. Service provider is a concept that is defined later on in the Act. But essentially, what service providers are is they are businesses that help other businesses, you know, do their job. So when you think of service providers, I mean, there's a variety of businesses that might be able to fit into this category, but you might think of an accounting firm performing an audit or a cybersecurity firm that's, you know, looking into whether or not you have good security procedures. Those would be, you know, some examples of service providers. And then as I talk a little bit more about this, one of the things we'll sort of go backwards with is we talked before about a disclosure request where a consumer can ask, who's my information been provided to? And the business would have to say who they provided that person's personal information to. There is sort of an exception built into that disclosure request for service providers. The business isn't required to tell the person which service providers it's given the information to. And I think part of the reason for that is that it might be, there might be significant sort of proprietary information for a business if they had to, for instance, tell everyone that they've hired a particular type of cybersecurity firm or a particular type of, you know, of accounting firm that engages in certain kinds of forensic audits that might, you know, give away some significant proprietary information about what's going on in the business. So there's an exclusion there for service providers. But so then what this section does is it creates obligations that service providers have, which I think help, you know, ensure that data is better protected. So first, a service provider can only maintain and retain the information in order to use it for the services the service provider is there to provide, auditing or cybersecurity or whatever it may be. Second, the service provider can't combine the information from one business with the information it gets from somewhere else in order to sort of get around this bill and learn more about, you know, a particular consumer. And then finally, information can't be disclosed unless there's a written consent from the business or the recipient, and there's a signed contract prohibiting a future recipient from engaging in further conduct that the service provider would be prohibited from doing. So then those concepts, I think the idea is then to help make sure that service providers aren't sending information further out into the world using that sort of chicken feathers analogy that we heard earlier. And if there's no questions there, I'll move on to 45.49.090. So 45.49.090 is an exemption section. This section exempts personal information collected in a wide variety of different circumstances. Many of those circumstances are information that's collected in such a way that privacy rights are already regulated by a federal law. So HIPAA information, information collected in clinical trials, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which deals with insurance companies and financial institutions, the Fair Credit Reporting Act. In addition to those kinds of things, there's an exemption for collection or sales of personal information that occur wholly outside of the state. So even though you may be a resident of the state of Alaska, if you fly down to Washington and a business collects your information there, that's not something the state would be able to regulate. So that's exempted. Let's see. There are also exemptions to the extent that information must be retained to comply with any federal law or a court order. There are also exemptions that exist to the extent that deleting information or disclosing information might infringe on the rights of someone else. There's also exemptions for privileges. So we have a number of exemptions in here, which if there's specific questions about those, maybe we can discuss them. I don't know if there are.
Not seeing any. And actually, Mr. Haley,
okay.
I think we're going to pause here and take a question from Mr. Kaufman and then have to move on to other legislation. We'll definitely return to this bill, and I know Ms. Mills has another appointment soon. So, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Law, or Mr. Haley. As I'm looking at all of this and thinking about it, I'm trying to picture the flow of data as it goes through the system, and I'm just wondering, have y'all put together anything like a flow diagram that shows the various decision points and the different actions that can come off of those decisions, just to see, to gap check and to reconcile how this all works together? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, I don't believe that anyone has put together a flow chart like you're describing.
Well, I hate to put work on people, but I think that would be an interesting exercise. I know we don't have the bandwidth to do it in my little office, but if we could just see or even talk about something like that, just a whiteboard exercise, I think it would be interesting to see how that maps out. There may be some gaps in what we're looking at here, and there may be some decision points that we could discover. That's all. Just a thought about an exercise. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I guess that this is it for the day, as I understand.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Haley, for answering all those questions and for your work on the bill. Definitely a lot of good ideas, and I look forward to returning it to it and having more discussions. I'm sorry we can't devote the whole hearing to it. So next up is, Representative McCarty.
The chair, am I understanding that next time we start, it's going to start at Article 2, or did we finish up with 45.49?
Yep, we made it through Article 1, and at the next hearing, I think we just take up the section on Article 2 and keep talking our way through it, if it makes sense to committee members. Thanks again, Mr. Haley and Ms. Mills, for being here. Next up is HB 146, Disclosure Wage Information, by Representative Snyder. This is the first hearing of the bill in Labor and Commerce, and after the sponsor presents the bill, we have some invited testimony from Hillary Morgan, and I believe Dan Wayne from Ledge Legal is online to answer questions as well. So please go ahead with your presentation, Representative Snyder.
Could we take a brief at ease?
At ease. On the record, first let's take up a CS as a working document, Representative Sponholz.
All right. I move that the House Labor and Commerce Committee take up CS for House Bill 146, Work Order 32-LS0513/B.
Not seeing any objection. We've adopted the CS as a working document. Please proceed, Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Chair Fields. And I will address as part of my introduction here the reasoning behind the CS and what's in there, as opposed to what was first read across. So thank you to everyone today. Thank you, Co-Chairs Fields and Sponholz, for the opportunity to present on HB 146. What this bill is seeking to do is to support fair hiring practices for the protection of all Alaskan workers, while also being cognizant and crafting it in such a way that we're ensuring employers are not placed at an unfair risk or disadvantage. And HB 146 approaches this in the following ways. There's three primary components, and I'll walk through each of those briefly. The first is pay privacy. So under this component of HB 146, applicants cannot be asked, nor could they be required to provide information on their past pay. And the idea behind this is that we are protecting their privacy and preventing past unfair or unrelated compensation from unduly impacting their economic potential. If we look across the United States, you will see that a total of 27 states and in some cases individual cities have laws that provide this protection. So we are not blazing new trail here, and there's some evidence to show what some of the effects of this are. And if you're following along at the federal level, you would see that the U.S. House of Representatives just very recently passed the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would also protect pay privacy. So if this act at the federal level were to pass, then HB 46, should it pass here, would be ensuring parity at the federal level. The second component of HB 146 we could classify as pay transparency. So in this case, applicants or employees must be allowed to discuss their salaries with one another if they so choose. It would be entirely up to them. And actually, if you look at Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, which has been in effect for decades, it already protects this type of discussion, and we have decades of case law to support the fact that it does protect this type of discussion. And further, in April of 2014, there was an executive order from the president that affected federal contractors as well. So this essentially would add to Alaska statute something that is already required and protected at the federal level, but not particularly well enforced. With respect to how many states already have their own level of pay transparency laws, that total comes to about 20. And similarly, HB 146 would bring some parity to national requirements. The third component we could call pay posting. So we talked about pay privacy, we talked about pay transparency, and HB 146 covers pay posting. So in this component, job announcements must include a pay range and other compensation details with the idea of helping to ensure applicants don't misdirect time and resources towards applying for jobs with compensation that doesn't meet their needs. Additionally, it would help employers avoid spending valuable time and resources interviewing applicants who ultimately wouldn't accept the available offer. And the example I've provided in talking with many of you, I think I made around to everyone but one, Representative Nelson, so I will have to have a visit with you as well. And as I was sharing details on this bill, having sat on several hiring committees in my previous place of employment, we expended dozens and dozens of hours and time, spent thousands of dollars recruiting, interviewing, even in cases paying for travel for site visits, to ultimately make an offer and it be found nearly laughable to the folks that we provided that offer to, because they were not aware of what the salary range was prior to accepting the invitation. Glassdoor, a very popular and highly used online job posting website, their estimates are that 1 in 10 job postings don't include pay information. And in 2017, they responded to applicant demand by providing salary range estimates on their website. And Colorado passed a similar law in 2020. This is of the three components of HB 146. This is one of the newer ideas, but I'll talk about how it's related to the other more well-tested ideas in just a moment. Those are the three parts. And, you know, we heard earlier today with the first bill hearing, there's this theme apparently we have today of privacy and making sure that we're also protecting business interests. But as Chair Fields highlighted a moment ago, it's also important if you're going to have rules in place, there needs to be a way to enforce it. So this bill also includes that consideration. So HB 146, it disallows retaliation against the applicant or an employee if they choose not to share their past pay or if they do choose or do not choose to discuss their wages with other employees. And then finally, HB 146 implements a small fine for violations. And in the way the bill is written now, and this is one of the ways that it's different, the CS, as I said I would address, is that originally we had directed those funds to essentially support the enforcement of these rules. But it was brought to our attention in speaking with the department, and we wanted to be responsive to that concern, that it could give the appearance, even if it wasn't actually doing this, that you're providing incentive to seek out problems that actually may not exist. So we took that to heart and we changed that, and it now any fines would be directed to the UGF. It's also worth noting, as written in the bill today, that any fines, that if an employer was not posting and it was alert, the department was alerted, and the employer was then alerted and they changed the job posting promptly, then the fine could be avoided. So the idea is not to be punitive, but to encourage these best practices. Also, in talking with many of you all, you raised some excellent points, and also speaking with the department, they raised some excellent points, and we wanted to make sure that we clarified a few things. HB 146 does not require an employer offer any specific pay range or compensation package. That remains completely as it should under the purview of the employer. And nor does it disallow their ability to offer something after they've conducted their interviews outside of that range that they've posted. The range is a starting point. It gives a potential applicant a general idea of where the conversations may begin. But if an employer, say, interviews just a wildly qualified star applicant that they're excited about, and they may have competing offers, and the employer has the ability to offer something outside the originally posted range, nothing in this bill would disallow them to do so. Similarly, if they had an applicant who showed great potential but maybe wasn't a great fit for that particular job, then they could offer a lower starting salary. There's nothing in there that would prevent them from doing it. It doesn't disallow the employer from asking different types of questions, like, what do you expect to earn? Those conversations can still occur. And the applicant, should they so choose, can also share their past pay history if they felt that that was something advantageous or something that they wanted to share. So I'm getting close to the end of my overview of this bill, I promise. Another question, and rightfully so, and I think legislators are smart to ask, what problem are we trying to solve with this bill? We certainly don't want to come up with solutions to things that aren't an issue. So it may be difficult to see, but we do have a growing body of evidence showing us that the issues that HB 146 is designed to address, they are pervasive and they are persistent. So just for example, looking at the issue of pay privacy, we have nationally representative studies from 2012, 2017, and 2019 that show us, depending on the study, anywhere between 30 and 47% of the respondents say that they have been asked about past wages. If you look at pay transparency and pay posting, which pay transparency and pay posting, a 2011 study reported that half of all workers, and it was evenly distributed between women and men, report the discussion of wage and salary information is either discouraged or prohibited and or could lead to punishment. And in a 2017 study, again, found that the prohibition of wage discussion was widespread, and it was actually evenly applied across demographics. This was a problem affecting everyone fairly evenly. I mentioned a moment ago that we changed the direction of the funds. A couple other examples of things that we changed in response to feedback, because we want to make sure this is something that feels good to everyone and is doing what we want it to do. Clarified language regarding contractors and how this bill does not apply to them, and cleaned up some language about what the bill does and doesn't do to better clarify what I just described in this introduction. And I am going to stop here. I may have some closing comments in response to discussion, and I will turn to Aliana Thalangit for the sectional analysis if the co-chair feels is ready.
Go for it.
For the record, Aliana Thalangit, staff to Representative Snyder. I think my boss did a very good job of going over the bill, but let's do this. So Section 1, it establishes the Superior Court as having jurisdiction over causes of action that arise under HB 146 and that an employee or employer can file a complaint with the Superior Court for relief. Section 2 is the meat of the bill. It adds a new section to already existing statute AS 2310, Employment Practices and Working Conditions, by adding Article 9, Disclosure of Employee Compensation. The new sections added under this article do the following. Section 2310-700, Disclosure of Discussion, this is the meat of the bill, requires job postings to include the salary or salary range, allows employees and applicants to freely discuss wages, protects individuals' salary history by preventing employers from asking about an applicant's salary history from another employer during the interview process. And again, please note that nothing in this section will obligate an individual or employee to discuss or share their wages, or prohibits an individual from voluntarily disclosing salary history, and nothing prevents an employer, if that information is voluntarily disclosed, from using that to determine an offer, and nothing also obligates an employer to offer a specific wage. Section 2310-705 requires employers to post an informational summary of the provisions of this bill. Section 2310-710 and 715 has the language that prevents employers from retaliating. Section 2310-720 provides a statute of limitation of 3 years for filing a civil claim, and that would be through the Superior Court. And then Section 2310-725 and 735 instructs the department and commissioner to interpret and implement these laws. And it creates a fine between $100 to $2,000 that the commissioner will determine, and the commissioner will determine what is and isn't a violation. And as Representative Snyder said, employers can conduct an internal audit to reduce the violation. But once again, that would still be at the discretion of the commissioner. Section 2310-790 defines an employee and employer. And the definition of employee was changed to incorporate feedback that we received with meetings from members and stakeholders so that it excludes independent contractors. Section 3 has conforming language, and Section 4 just has an effective date of July 1st, 2021.
Thank you very much.
Would you like to proceed with the invited testimony before additional questions?
Thank you, Chair Fields. We have one individual for invited testimony today, and should the committee be ready to have a second hearing, we will have additional folks on the line early morning on a Friday. Is a tough sell. We have Hillary Morgan on Teams. She is former CEO of the YWCA, and she is speaking as herself this morning.
Please proceed, Ms. Morgan.
She's on mute.
Oh, Ms. Morgan, I think you're on mute. It looks like you're still muted.
There you go. Hello?
Now we can hear you. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. Good morning, Representative Snyder. Thank you for asking me to testify, and also other representatives in the room. My name is Hillary Morgan. I am here to speak today in support of HB 146, the disclosure of wage information. HB 146 would be a huge mitigator in equalizing the playing field for women and people of color in finding and attaining fair wage employment. When I was CEO of YWCA Alaska, I worked on an initiative to close the gender pay gap in Alaska, and we worked extensively with the Alaska's Department of Labor studying wages in Alaska. What we found astounded me. In looking at that data of male versus female median earnings of full-time year-round workers, we found that women made less than men in every part of Alaska and in every single market sector. We found that the wage gap persisted regardless of industry, was present in every occupation, and existed regardless of education level. And both men and women of color make less than white men in many sectors in many market sectors in Alaska. The reason why this is important is when discussing the issue of asking what a applicant made in their previous job, this then makes it so that it can potentially perpetuate historically discriminative practices instead of noting a level of worth or merit in the current applicant. And HB 146 would mitigate this by making it illegal to ask that question. With regarding to paid posting, the salary range posting on all job announcements, in conjunction with our gender pay gap initiative, we taught salary negotiation classes. And in our research and class findings, we found that there's a double standard when it comes to salary negotiation between men and women and people of color. When men negotiate, they're seen as take charge guys, closers, and strong. And when women negotiate, they're seen as aggressive, bossy, and potentially as not being a team player. Often when people of color negotiate, they're seen as overstepping or ungrateful. And anyone who has been an executive responsible for budgets knows that if a manager can save on a salary as a result of the applicant asking for too little, they often will do so. People are rarely given more money than they ask for. And conversely, anyone who is interviewed for a job knows that asking for salary numbers during the interview is looked upon unfavorably. The combination of these things puts women and people of color at a disadvantage when seeking employment in Alaska without HB 146 as law. Hiring managers always know what the salary range is on every job. Budgets can't be done without this knowledge well before any particular applicant applies. So there's really no reason not to list the salary ranges. And as Representative Snyder stated earlier, when I was a CEO, I found that listing the range in the job announcement actually streamlined my hiring processes. Having all applicants already comfortable with the range, otherwise they wouldn't apply for the job. So it never limited me from offering more to an applicant who might be excellent and ask for more, but it did inhibit me from lowballing an applicant who might have taken less than I was offering. So I believe that HB 146 would mitigate the issues I've spoke of here that definitely do exist in our current employment market, and therefore I'm offering my strong support for its passage. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Do members have questions for the bill sponsor, her staff, or Ms. Morgan? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, Representative Snyder, the bill right now, would it be mainly employees that see, you know, coming online or wherever the job posting is, reporting that to the Department of Labor saying, hey, you know, they're not disclosing that they have this?
Yes. So it was designed this way intentionally, trying to streamline and reduce personnel requirements. So it would be reported. So if I were an applicant and I saw a job that was posted and it didn't have the required information, I would report that to the department. What this bill also does is gives the authority to the department to generate the regulations for how they would decide how to address that complaint, what the process would be and what the required documentation would be.
Following. And the Department of Labor would be able to handle that, Representative Snyder?
So we've had discussions with them. We can talk about the fiscal note that they offered. They currently have 13 investigators working on issues around focused on minimum wage and on prevailing wage.
Yeah, I mean, the only hiccup I've seen is it's a good bill. The only thing is, you know, having a $300,000 fiscal note is it's kind of tough to justify when, you know, it's a lot of self-reporting, and the Department of Labor can easily, or not easily, but be able to work around this or help, you know, with the investigations on it.
I appreciate that very much, Representative Nelson. And when we got that fiscal note, it was a little bit of a surprise. And we've had discussions with the department about how they came to that fiscal note, and I would welcome hearing from them about what their process was. We have done We have done, we also have the Department of Law on Labor, to answer questions. Thank you, Aliana. We have done some research since getting that fiscal note that caught us a little off guard. So as I stated before, there are several states who have enacted laws very similar to this within in terms of scope, but in states that have much larger populations or similar populations. If you look at Delaware, a population of 1 million people, in 2017 they passed a similar law. There was no fiscal note recommended. In Maryland, with a population of 6 million people, they allotted $5,000 to develop educational materials, and that was the end of the fiscal note. California, which is much larger than us, they had a negligible note for fiscal note. Minnesota did offer $100,000 for initial education and sharing of information as we implement it. Nebraska had a zero fiscal note, and Colorado, with a population of 6 million, offered a 1.5 FTE. So there is quite a range, and again, I'm sure there may be there's other folks on the line who may wish to address this as well, but that's what we found in our research.
Well, this is a good time to turn to Joe Dunham with the Wage and Hour Administration, and I guess my view would be Title 23 is minimum wage statutes. So you've already got staff there to enforce the law, and you know, my view would be if we pass this law, we're adding to their responsibilities, and then whether we actually add staff or not is a decision we would make in subsequent rounds of the budget. So I don't see the logic in having any meaningful fiscal note, because I would like to add staff to the Department of Labor, but you know, whether people like me prevail in the budget process is to be determined. So, Mr. Dunham, if you could address this fiscal note issue, and you know, if you could also address, seems to me we're just adding a requirement to your staff, and couldn't you make the decision to, you know, correct the fiscal note to zero or negligible, and then hope that we add capacity in the future, which certainly would be my goal.
Hi, through the chair, this is Joe Dunham, Chief Investigator of the Wage and Hour Administration here in the Anchorage office. The logic behind adding to the fiscal note here is the underlying message of this law is equal pay, which I think, equal pay for equal work. And when we encourage and allow workers to discuss their wages, I can see all kinds of responses, problems coming to our department. So this would, we're foreseeing adding three investigators to handle just the onslaught of calls, termination, maybe retaliation, maybe going back for back wages. It is foreseeing a problem. I have not looked at these other states with zero fiscal notes. I suppose just putting up a poster would be a zero fiscal note. But when we start encouraging these workers to compare their wages, I foresee a lot of investigations coming.
Representative Snyder.
I think if that were to be the case, if there was an onslaught of complaints, then I think it simply further justifies the need for this piece of legislation.
Okay, and through the chair, that might be. I don't know about that. I can just see a lot of these investigations going nowhere, where someone may have terminated and then they find out afterwards they were making less, they want an investigation. I see a lot of investigations coming on this.
All right, thank you.
I would also say that most of them would be fruitless.
Representative Snyder, this is co-chair Sponholz. I have a question about the three-year sort of limitation. Does that apply to all provisions of the bill, or just sort of that initial discussion? Does it include the pay transparency statute of limitations?
As written now, yes.
All right. that might put a little bit of a sideboard on it. Did you have an additional question, Rep. Nelson?
Yes.
All right.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Steiner, for addressing that. You know, it's a little bit of back and forth, especially with the large fiscal note. And a little bit of a change of subject. You were referencing a little bit earlier about the federal law that's going through right now through the U.S. Congress. If that were to pass and be signed by President Biden, would you be pulling the bill? Would you be keeping that on board? How would that, you know, ebb and flow look like?
I think it's pretty typical for us to have laws and state statute that are that mirror what we see at the federal level. So I don't think that would be unnecessary, but I would certainly defer to, say, Ledge Legal or law, who would indicate whether or not we would need to make an adjustment.
And I don't have the monitor. Hang on. All right, we have Dan Wayne with Legislative Legal. Do you want to talk about sort of the difference in where the federal law would apply and where the state would apply and how these might complement one another?
Well, I don't really know of any federal law that requires posting a salary range. This is Dan Wayne from Ledge Legal for the record. Through the chair, I don't know of a federal law that does that. I don't know a federal law that protects the rights of employees to discuss how much they make, you know, amongst themselves, if they choose to do that, other than, you know, there's maybe freedom of speech or, you know, constitutional protections that are sort of, you know, general. And so I don't really know. Can't think of a federal law that is really mirrors this, or, you know, already does what this bill does.
And Mr. Dunham, did you want to address the question?
I didn't really understand the question, I guess.
Would you like to restate your question, Rep. Nelson?
Yeah. I was just merely looking and seeing, you know, Representative Sanders referencing a federal law that would pass, and it would be almost hand in hand with this legislation, if I mistook that at all.
No, and I'll provide further clarification for those on the line. I was referencing the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would be a new federal law that would address pay privacy, so not being allowed to, or applicants not having to provide their past pay history to potential employers. We already do have 27 states or cities that have this law, and if this were to pass, it would be a complement, but I guess just like everywhere else, we would have to reevaluate and make sure that we didn't have some sort of provision that conflicted. And again, maybe we can turn back to our lawyers for additional clarification.
And that's what I was asking about was, no, it was just seeing, you know, what the difference was, or seeing if there was any conflict between this and the federal legislation.
If it were to pass.
If it were to pass, mm-hmm. Of course.
All right. And Representative McCarty was up next.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Dunham, you mentioned that this could potentially bring an increase in people investigations and such. I guess a question in this is like, what's the average of investigations that you are dealing with on a monthly basis, and what numbers would you see this percentage-wise bring an increase?
Well, let's see. I'm sorry, through the chair. We're talking about three different things. One is posting the wages at the time of advertising the job. I don't see that causing any conflict or problem or any increase whatsoever to our department. The second part about asking about previous wages, I don't see that causing much of a stir or an increase in our workload at all either. although most jobs, and speaking from a hiring manager of 30 years in the private sector, most hiring, the initial wage is a contractual amount and it's negotiated. The employer wants to put this person on as low as possible, and that employee wants to come on as high as possible. So they have to negotiate. I think that the wages are ultimately negotiated. That in and of itself is not going to cause much of a stir at all. What the part that I would be interested to see whether or not the other states do this is where they're encouraging employees to discuss their wages amongst each other. That, I think, is going to cause the problem. If I hire a mechanic at $26 an hour, and then I hire this next one at $30 an hour, I'm going to tell him, don't talk about your wages, because it's going to cause a problem. The $26 an hour mechanic is going to cause a fuss. He could ask, or he would probably contact us. I foresee that as a discrimination of some sort, or equal pay for equal work, or something along that line. When many factors are used to negotiate these wages, they're not all equal. Anyway, that is the part that I think is going to cause the uptick in our
Thank you, Mr. Dunham.
In our workload.
We're going to go to Representative Snyder, then Representative Goffman, and then we're going to have to move on to Representative Nelson's bill, because I do want to get that passed today. And then we'll come back for another hearing on wage disclosure and maybe make sure we have plenty of time to talk through all these issues. Representative Snyder.
Yes, thank you. And I think the point that was just brought up highlights how important the education rollout piece is, so individuals and employees and employers fully understand what this bill does and does not cover. And I think a well-focused and well-done rollout would do much to mitigate a possible onslaught. I think, too, we have to be careful in these conversations to distinguish between policy preferences and estimates of what a particular policy would cost to implement and monitor. And the last thing I would add as a reminder, it's Colorado, and correct me, Aliana, also California, that have the pay range posting requirement. And in California, the cost was negligible. And in Colorado, as I mentioned earlier, it was a 1.5 FTE for a population of 6 million.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Snyder. I'm looking at page 2 and down to line 22, which says nothing in this section creates an obligation for an employee or applicant for employee to disclose information, et cetera. So it's saying they won't be forced to. But I'm wondering if by default, if the employer is posting this information, there's kind of a loop there that I'm struggling with.
Yeah.
And so have you considered that, of ways to mitigate that? I mean, sometimes people may not want people knowing what they're getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a few times like that in my life. And, you know, you just dress nice and play through. So that's something maybe we can talk about later. And then the other thing that I'm curious about, are there any protections in here for employers that want to compensate high performers, people that just go the extra mile? But if somehow that's being put out there, and then you get people that are, they feel like it's unfair, but in reality, and we've all seen it, somebody's doing a bunch of work and maybe they need to get paid for it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Let's, if we could, do you want to answer that now?
I do. Can I?
Yes, go.
Thank you. So the first question being this relationship between the pay privacy, which is sometimes called a salary history ban. You'll also see that in the literature. It actually is connected in a positive way with pay posting. It's one of the reasons why we've included both in this bill. There is evidence to show that when a salary history ban or pay privacy is implemented, it actually naturally causes employers to gravitate towards posting a salary. We've seen this in recent research. So it kind of eliminates this need to ask about pay history, because an applicant comes in prepared to have this conversation about what the possible pay range might be. To your second question, no, nothing in this bill, and we were very careful when we asked specifically about that, and would prohibit an employer from doing any sort of bonus or additional pay increase or whatever the vehicle might be to reward good work. They would not be limited from doing that. If there was concern about language in the bill and we wanted to spell that out more specifically, we'd certainly be open to that. I know one of the common approaches is also listing things like commensurate with experience or other types of language, and that would absolutely be permitted under this particular piece of legislation.
Thank you, Representative Snyder. So we're going to hold this bill. The amendment deadline, I think, was already set for Tuesday at noon. The second hearing will be on Wednesday. If members have additional questions about the data on pay equity and the impact of the policies presented by Representative Snyder, please work with her or Hillary Morgan. There is a ton of research that is behind this bill, and it's pretty fascinating to review. What's that?
Department of Labor.
And Department of Labor actually has looked into the gender pay gap as well. So next up, we have House Bill 125, Representative Nelson and his staff, Kim Skipper. This is the second hearing of the bill in House Labor and Commerce. Does the sponsor have additional remarks before we turn to amendments?
I guess I can just...
I'm fine if you just...
Okay, whatever is easier. No, I'm just very excited to hopefully have this passed out of Labor and Commerce and see it on the floor. We can go to amendments.
Me too. Does anyone have amendments?
Yeah, I move amendment A.1.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Yeah, this amendment, and I'm very supportive of the bill, and talked with Representative Nelson here the other day about the bill. Very, very supportive of what this bill hopes to achieve. My concern was simply that, you know, I can think of many families that are maybe in an unfortunate situation that have dependents that the family would certainly benefit from having that dependent employed and in the workforce. However, you know, I think that there are some concerns in specifically carving out military families for state preferential hiring evaluations for those dependents. You know, I think when we have Gold Star families or prisoner of war families, I think there's certainly a exacerbated need for that support for those dependents, for those military spouses. However, outside of that, you know, I just want to limit the scope of this bill a little bit and cut out simply from the state side of things, removing that hiring preference for dependents of military families, unless, again, they're part of a prisoner of war family or a Gold Star family. And happy to answer any questions about the amendment or the scope of it.
Thank you. Is there further discussion? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair to Representative Shoggy and to the committee. You know, I do support where Representative Shoggy is coming from, you know, specifically narrowing that focus to Gold Star family dependents and prisoner of war dependents. I do want to let it know to the committee that, you know, although I do support the amendment, I want to make it clear that, you know, dependents still go through a lot. You know, we like to think, you know, that lower enlisted or the 18 to 20 year olds, but there are some military individuals who are a little bit on the older side who have children that are 13 through 18, and bringing a kid like that from across the country every year, every 2 years, is difficult. And having a job, say at Target to Walmart to maybe even another place, helps them set down the roots a little bit easier and to assimilate into their new community a little bit faster.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Hearing that, I'm going to withdraw my objection. Is there further objection to this amendment? Okay. Seeing no objection, Amendment 1 passes. Do members have further amendments? Seeing none, do we have a motion to move House Bill 125 as amended?
Co-Chair Fields, I make a motion to move HB 125 version 32
LS0602/A as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, House Bill 125 passes from the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Next up, we have House Bill 75, Employer Contributions to PERS. This is the second hearing of the bill, and I believe Mr. Steininger and Ms. Schultz are here. In addition, I believe, well, okay, yes. Mr. Steininger and Ms. Schultz are here, and we also have invited testimony. Mr. Steininger and Ms. Schultz, do you have additional testimony before we turn to Nils Andreessen? Okay. Invited testimony today is Nils Andreessen with Alaska Municipal League. Mr. Andreessen, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nils Andreessen. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. Calling in support of this bill, I can imagine that some of the concerns that might be raised have to do with the bill's impacts to local governments. And while it's true, the PERS system in particular, does impact 64 local governments. If there were significant changes made to PERS, and it's definitely a priority of ours. Our understanding is that this bill wouldn't negatively impact or impact at all local governments. What this bill does is allow the state to charge the full actuarially determined rate to all of its fund sources, including, and in particular, federal, which just wouldn't apply at the local level. The amount of federal or other types of funding that come into local governments, nowhere near the same scale, and so it wouldn't have the same kind of benefit at the local level. And as long as this bill kind of retains protects local governments from changing the rate of 22% at our level, then we think it's a good thing for the state to be able to charge the full rate and potentially find savings in that change. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Do members have questions for Nils Andreessen? Not seeing any, I guess I would just note that I know the administration and Representative Sponholz and I also touch base with public employee unions to make sure that their members were aware that this would not increase employee contribution to PERS. So in other words, public employees would be held harmless as well. We did not receive any amendments for this bill. The last step for this bill will be taking public testimony at the next hearing. So we will have that public testimony and then be prepared to take action on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Steininger and Ms. Schultz, for being here. And I think that brings us to the end of the hearing. Thank you, Leah and Tom. Is there further business to come before the House Labor and Commerce Committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned at 9:40.